Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Kim Williams, MD. Dr. Kim Williams is one of the most impeccably credentialed cardiologists in the world today. He's a fellow and a trustee for the American College of Cardiology, for which he served as president in 2015 and 2016. He has board certifications in internal medicine, cardiovascular diseases, nuclear medicine, nuclear cardiology, and cardiovascular computed tomography. Dr. Williams has served on the faculty of the Pritzker School of Medicine, the Wayne State University School of Medicine, and at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, where he's the head of the cardiology department. Dr. Williams has also served as chairman of the Coalition of Cardiovascular Organizations and chairman of the board of the Association of Black Cardiologists. He grew up on the south side of Chicago, where access to healthcare was a struggle for him and for his family. Since then, he's dedicated much of his life to expanding healthcare access to low-income and inner-city communities, and he's also a leader in bringing nutritional awareness into cardiology practice, which is something that we're excited to talk with him about today. So now, Dr. Williams, my dad and I are so grateful for your work and to have this opportunity to share your voice in the summit. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, for that splendid introduction of Dr. Kim Williams. And I want to say what an honor it is to have you with us today.
It's certainly my pleasure.
Well, ours too. You know, is it true that you are the first African-American, the first former tennis pro, and the first vegan to be the president of the American College of Cardiology?
Interestingly enough, that's true on all three accounts. Nuclear cardiologist, that one is not true. George Beller in 1990 was the first nuclear cardiologist to be. I happen to be the second.
Well, you're breaking ground and a pioneer in many, many respects, and we appreciate that. And I want to talk with you in depth about what people can do to increase the health of their hearts and prevent cardiovascular disease. Statins are the biggest selling drug or the biggest selling class of pharmaceutical compounds of all time. Annual sales now are in excess of $22 billion. The most popular statin, Lipitor, is the most financially successful drug of all time. Now, statins have obviously and unquestionably saved lives. But I must say, it gives me pause. And I want to know how you feel about this. When I see cardiologists eating steak dinners and then taking statins and then telling their patients it's fine to do that too, wouldn't it be a lot better in most cases to eat a whole foods, plant-strong diet, to get plenty of plant-based nutrition, and so not need to take these pills in the first place?
Indeed, you've really hit the nail on the head. I like to make analogies, if they're not too annoying. I like to refer to statins really as duct tape. I mean, there are situations where you really cannot survive without duct tape. you've got a situation that's occurred, and you can get around the problem. But how about stopping the problem from happening in the first place or treating the real cause instead of just putting a Band-Aid, no matter how great a Band-Aid it happens to be?
Well, I'm grateful for statins and the many advances in heart disease treatment that have lowered the death rate from hypertension and from heart attacks a lot in the last 30 years. But with you and with our audience, I'm sure we are all wanting to do more in the way of prevention. I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Doctors Caldwell Esselstyn and Dean Ornish. Yes?
Indeed. They're good friends and they're luminaries who have really moved the field forward in very many ways. If I could be a little more specific, I would say that they have been leaders in the getting the mind of medicine a little bit more away from just mopping up the floor instead of turning off the faucet. That is, we should be able to actually take this plaque problem that we've had, which is epidemic proportions, killing more Americans than any other disease for the last nearly 100 years since 1918. And let's actually make the plaque regress. And it's interesting that so far we've talked about the three things that have been shown to regress plaque, and that is statins, but only in very high doses of the very, very strongest statins, the Esselstyn diet and the Ornish diet. And why not make it all go away?
Well, the Ornish diet is, as far as I know, the only diet that's ever been proven in randomized control trials to reverse the progression of coronary heart disease using direct measures of coronary atherosclerosis and myocardial perfusion, the blood flow to the heart. And Dr. Esselstyn often says that based on Ornish's work and his own careful research, heart disease is a paper tiger that need never exist, and if it exists, it need never progress. So what I want to ask you, Kim, is this. When you get right down to it, how much heart disease do you think we could actually expunge if we were, as a nation, to shift to a whole foods, plant-strong diet and make other basic lifestyle changes such as quitting smoking?
I like to say, and it may be an overestimate, that we would have some issues in cardiovascular medicine, such as congenital heart disease, but there would be some acquired heart disease. I think our valvular issues may actually increase over time because of the longevity that would occur if everyone was on a thin, exercising vegan, the TEV, as I call them. Okay, but I would probably have to, retire probably 30 of our 35 cardiologists here at Rush if this were to happen, because we wouldn't be managing the major issues that we are dealing with today. Complications of diabetes, stroke, hypertension, complications of obesity and metabolic syndrome, heart attack, sudden cardiac death, surviving and having ICDs, and a lot of the heart failure. There are so many things that would go away if we were all to be on plant-based nutrition and having a good lifestyle in terms of watching our weight and doing adequate exercise.
I'm wondering if there's a contradiction here where if we ask the cardiological community to promote healthy diets that could eliminate 30 of 35 of their jobs, six-sevenths of their jobs, is there a built-in contradiction there?
Well, it's interesting that I think most of cardiologists who have heard me talk about this, standing in front of the American College of Cardiology, getting an applause when I said something that I thought would be very controversial, which was, wouldn't it be great to eliminate our specialty in the next two generations? Well, I think the fact that people are applauding is because they recognize that this is relatively low-hanging fruit. There are some very difficult things in cardiovascular medicine. This isn't one of them in terms of the science. The hard part is the behavioral change that's necessary. But if we were to solve that in a large scale, these cardiologists are pretty well trained. They're very talented people. They could do other things for a living. And the issues that we have with overworking cardiologists coming in the middle of the night for heart attacks and the like, lifestyle would be dramatically better. Sure, income would go down, but job satisfaction would go up.
If you have a patient with advanced heart disease, if you can show them a narrowed artery on an angiogram or a CT scan, if you can show them a defect, will they then be more open to making significant changes in their eating patterns?
I think they really are able to visualize a lot of this. And I actually do show in my clinic, whenever this comes up, I go to a search engine and I actually pull up Caldwell Esselstyn's reversal, then hit images. And that first angiogram that comes up where there's a 32-month elimination of a massive amount of a plaque burden. The patients, even if they've never seen anything that looks like a coronary angiogram before, they can understand the idea of a blocked pipe in their house, and the pipe then being perfectly clean. It's a very good visual.
When you talk about the images that you show to your patients, I'm thinking about the significance of the PET studies that Ornish has done. Our listeners may not realize that PET studies, positron emission tomography studies, are actually very sophisticated, and they're used in nuclear medicine, which is your specialty, and they depend on a scanning device that is extremely expensive. Most researchers really don't have access to PET studies, but Ornish did, and he published research that I believe showed that if you take people with critical coronary disease and you put them on a plant-strong whole foods diet, along with a few other very basic lifestyle changes, their blood flow improves dramatically without stents, without bypass procedures, and back then, even without drugs.
It's very interesting that we're looking at a couple of different things. And believe it or not, this actually has been shown with nuclear cardiology and statins as well, that before the plaque actually is gone, or before this time for a substantial reduction in the so-called percent diameter stenosis, or that is, you know, how much is the width of an artery depleted by the plaque, before that can actually change, you see improvement in blood flow with diet. You'd see it with statins. You actually can see it with exercise as well. But the effect of it is actually much faster than the anatomic improvement. That has to do with this so-called endothelium. Each one of our arteries is lined by a living organ called the endothelium, and those endothelial cells respond to their environment. And when you have this ugly inflammatory goop inside of a plaque, the biochemical milieu does not lend itself for normal function of the endothelium. And so there will be limitations in flow that can be induced just by one fatty meal that will last for 6 hours at a time. And, of course, what, as Michael Greger likes to say, well, what do they do after 6 hours? They eat again. yet another high-fat meal. And so we end up with problems with myocardial blood flow, with brain blood flow, with erectile function, all of which could be eliminated in hours by changing to a plant-based diet.
You mentioned erectile dysfunction. There's a urologist, you probably know him, Dr. Terry Mason.
I know him very well, yes.
Yeah, he says heart disease starts in the penis.
Yep.
He says the stiffer the arteries, the softer the penis.
Yep.
As a cardiologist, do you see a correlation between cardiovascular disease and erectile dysfunction? And does that mean, if there is that the same dietary changes that have been shown to literally reverse and prevent heart disease would also be effective in reversing and preventing erectile dysfunction?
You're absolutely right. When I ran the University of Chicago Nuclear Cardiology Lab, this was one of the first places to actually publish the correlation between erectile dysfunction and severity of coronary heart disease. So it's been pretty well known for a while that there's a correlation. Now, what you're asking is something that still needs to be investigated in an organized, randomized fashion. What happens to tumescence and every aspect of erectile function when one changes the diet, and what's the time course? We have a lot of anecdotes. We have a lot of patients coming back and saying, you know, I'm bothering my wife now. She's going through menopause, and all of a sudden my erectile function is not something that she can deal with. and that presents its own set of problems, I understand, but it's a good sign to the cardiologist that the blood vessel function has improved significantly.
Well, and it kind of puts into a kind of a dubious category the thinking that beef is real food for real men and masculinity is somehow measured by how much meat people eat.
Indeed. So if once we start talking about the meat, there's something that everyone should know, and that is that there's this large amount of literature, and it's no longer anecdotes. It's large amounts of very well-heeled, peer-reviewed literature that talks about the detrimental effects of meat, particularly about mortality. And I know I'm a cardiologist, spend most of my time talking about, heart disease. But to have a person improve their heart and die anyway isn't what we're looking for. So I would refer everyone, whether they're a scientist, a physician, a layperson, or a vegetarian who wants to convince someone else to go vegetarian, to look up the September 1st issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. It has an article that specifically describes the death rate increase by the consumption of animal protein.
And that was in the September 1st, 2016.
Absolutely. And so there's this one graphic that I've tweeted it out and I've shared it with so many people, and it's on the ninth page, page 1461. People could look at that one table. It's a, you know, it's a Fisher plot, but even a layperson can see, you know, favors plant protein is on the left, favors animal protein on the right. There's nothing on the right in terms of other cause of death, cancer death, cardiovascular death, or all-cause death. And you'd have to be ignoring death to eat animals after looking at the science of this.
You're saying, if I'm understanding you correctly, that this, the longstanding belief that animal protein is superior, it's more complete than plant-based protein, is actually not only untrue and misleading, but dangerous, because you're saying, and the data is saying, that the more our protein derives from animal products, the more likely we are to die of all causes.
That's exactly right.
Well, you're an athlete. You have been a tennis pro. You're in great shape, I know. And you are a vegan.
Indeed.
From your experience, and I'm sure you monitor your body carefully as a highly trained cardiologist, are you thriving on a vegan diet? I mean, how is your athletic performance there? Is your ability to function in your highly stressed career up to speed?
Well, indeed. And it's hard to do a single person experiment, but I can tell you several observations for the wider population. So if you were to take athletes in general and you put them all on a plant-based diet, you're going to find that you're going to excel in things that require quickness and agility and even endurance. But if you try doing a power training, wrestling, football, interior lineman, that sort of thing, plant-based nutrition is probably not the best. Now, interestingly enough, if you look at what happens to those athletes who do the power training, and they're eating large amounts of animal products and they have a successful, you know, National Football League career, what happens to them when they're in their 50s? If dramatic changes to their diet are not made, they end up with premature death very frequently. So you have this short-term gain and decrease in longevity when you're successfully athleticizing with animal products.
Today, we know that the NFL interior linemen, though their careers are short and they make a lot of money, they are rich and famous and prestigious in their way, they die very early. The average lifespan of NFL linemen is in the 50s. They die as on average in their mid-50s. It's really a short-term benefit, if any,
right,
and the cost in terms of the quality of their life and certainly the length of their life seems very high.
Well, and it's interesting, and I don't know these gentlemen very well, but I do have two particular standouts from the NFL, from the Purple People Eaters and the Fearsome Foursome. Fred Dreyer, who became a famous actor,
yeah,
and the Honorable Alan Page.
Yep.
And what they shared, and they have gotten into their 70s without any difficulty, no health problem. What they share is being thin. They somehow made that switch, and it had to be diet, lifestyle, something that they did, but that's not generally what happens. There's usually a significant increase in non-muscular weight, which then will have all of the negative effects, such as diabetes, hypertension, metabolic syndrome, et cetera.
There's been a lot of controversy about nuts and olive oil and other fats and their role in a heart healthy diet. My take is that if you're someone with advanced heart disease, you've got acute symptoms, you've got very tight blockages, you're a candidate for bypass surgery, then in that case, an Esselstyn-type diet that's vegan and very low fat might really be helpful and might, in fact, be the best way to go. If you follow an Ornish-type diet, a whole foods, plant-strong diet that includes some healthy fats, olive oil, seeds, and nuts, then you're very likely to prevent those kinds of problems from arising in the first place. So it depends on where you are on the spectrum about what would be the optimum diet for you. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that completely, but let me refine it a little bit. I do get people with three-vessel coronary artery disease, tight stenosis, and one difficulty that we've had in the field of cardiology is putting in a stent or doing a bypass and never telling the patient what it was that got them there in the first place and how they need to change it. That's something that we all in cardiology need to recognize and we need to change. The next issue, though, is that the more severe the patient, the more stringent the diet really needs to be. And I don't know that olive oil specifically increases plaque, but I do know that absence of olive oil based on Caldwell-Esselstyn studies will decrease the plaque pretty fast. And so I'd add one category to it, and that is people with or without coronary artery disease who have risk factors and they have obesity as a major issue, moderate or morbid obesity. I always recommend the Esselstyn diet. And that's based on something that I remember hearing at one of Dr. McDougall's courses. The fat you eat is the fat you wear. That line it sticks in your head. It's very true. We have learned recently that there were problems with the presentation of science with sugar. I'm not sure if you heard about that controversy a few weeks ago.
Oh, yes.
But to summarize it quickly, a Sugar Research Foundation people back in their inception had actually convinced folks at an Ivy League institution to suppress research, and this was all written up in the Journal of American Medical Association. So I took two lessons away from that. Number one, if I'm going to do something nefarious, hide the paperwork so that after I'm gone, no one will know. But saying that jokingly, of course. But the second lesson is that it's not just the fat you eat is the fat you wear, but the sugar you eat is the fat you wear, and that both sugar and saturated fat have exactly the same effect on cardiovascular death.
When you talk about sugar and saturated fat, I think of ice cream. It is the epitome of sugar and saturated fat. You may not know, my father was the founder and owner of Baskin-Robbins, 31 Flavors, the ice cream company.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was groomed to succeed him. It was his expectation that I would follow in his footsteps and run the company. I chose a very different direction because I didn't want to make my living selling a product that might undermine people's health. It's one of the reasons I do the work I do, is that I feel so strongly that just as ice cream is bad for you in any kind of excess, healthy food, plant-strong diets, is great for you and not only prevent disease, but enhance your health, make you more vital, more vibrant, more emotionally resilient, more intellectually and cognitively capable. They just make life more joyful.
Indeed.
I want to ask you, thinking about a study that we were talking about fat a moment ago, and there was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. I imagine you're familiar with it. They reported a randomized trial of three different diets. One was a low-fat diet. One was a low-fat diet that included statins. And the other was a vegan diet that included plenty of beans and fiber and plant sterols, and that also included a handful of almonds three times a day. And they found that the vegan diet with almonds lowered LDL cholesterol every bit as much as the statins, and also lowered C-reactive protein, which is very important, even faster than the statins did. So what I want to ask you, Kim, is, first of all, are you familiar with the study?
Well, not only am I familiar, that for me was pivotal and life-changing. That was published the day after I went vegan.
Oh, my.
In March of 2003.
Tell us.
It was the I had gone to the American College of Cardiology meeting in Dallas, had as I hadn't done it in a couple years, realizing just sort of after the fact that that was when I stopped being pretty much a full-time tennis coach. All of a sudden, I'm overwhelmed with work, and I'm working out, but certainly not twice a day, and not at the same level. At the same time, I'm eating this heart healthy, you can't see the air quotes,
yes.
Diet with no red meat, no fried foods, just chicken breast, no skin, not fried, and salmon.
The typical diet that's considered a healthy diet.
Exactly. And without ever having Googled the terms cholesterol content of chicken breast or cholesterol content of salmon. And I did that after the fact and realized that I was eating a very high cholesterol diet. It was low fat, but I wasn't fat. That wasn't my issue. And so as it turns out, it was very great to have David Jenkins right on time tell me not just, I knew I needed to be a vegan, but the question is how. And I adopted that portfolio diet. It was a little daunting with the keeping up with the busy schedule with the three handfuls of almonds every day, but doing it as much as I could. The interesting thing was that 6 weeks later, my LDL had dropped from 170 milligrams per deciliter down to 90.
That is a great, that is tremendous confirmation.
Indeed.
Now, people are often told to get their cholesterol checked, and then they find out their total cholesterol levels, their LDL, their HDL, and we can measure particle density and subparticles and oxidized LDL and so many other things. One of the results of this is a lot of people are confused. What's most important for people to understand?
Number one is that if you try to break down, just remember that the total cholesterol is a combination of everything, and it may or may not be a good or a bad thing. Triglycerides are small fat in the blood. We used to call the cholesterol components the good, the bad, and the ugly. This is the ugly. It does make your bloodstream look ugly. You get this white coat in it after you eat the bacon and eggs in the morning. And it's running around creating havoc inside the blood vessels, as well as making the LDL particles more dense. Dense LDL particles are more likely to go inside of an artery and make plaque than non-LDL dense particles. And so we really like to get the triglycerides down. The other thing about it is that it is a great, great lifestyle marker. If someone is doing alcohol, sugar, a large amount of starch, fried food, not exercising, big belly, insulin resistant, headed toward diabetes, your triglycerides are almost always high.
I still find it sad, though, that so many people wait until they get sick to do something about a problem that could have been prevented in the first place. There are a lot of people who hear about the Ornish program, they hear about the work of Dr. Esselstyn, but they just file it away. They don't think it's relevant to them. They think they're doing fine, and why fix what isn't broken? If you had their attention, and if you could speak totally freely to them, what would you want to say to them?
This is a really good question. And what I would like them to do is just shadow me for a week and see the number of people who come in with heart attacks, come in with strokes, have atherosclerotic aortic aneurysms, for example. I hope that they don't see an atherosclerotic plaque in the mesenteric artery. Those are really disastrous cases. But the amputations of the feet and that sort of thing, you know, once you see all of that, if you know that it's totally preventable, it really should have an impact on you. But you're quite correct that we have much more traction in people who have had events than we have in people who have not had events. The thing that's difficult for me is my colleagues in cardiology. It would seem, I haven't seen data on it, I would love to collect data on it, but it seems to me that now that I'm getting up in the 60s a little bit, that the leading cause of death in cardiologists is heart disease.
Oh my, isn't that telling?
Doesn't that tell us something? Yeah, I mean, I have, you know, electricians and plumbers in my clinic. They don't have problems with their wiring and their pipes respectively. So why would a cardiologist die of heart disease? It's because we are so good at mopping up the floor that there isn't a major concern at a personal level about changing things. And so we do, you know, I preach this all the time. I have to admit, out of my 35 cardiologists, I have 4 vegans. And so we're changing things at Rush, but it's a process to try to get this to the entire cardiovascular community. And the reason I think it's so key is that once that happens, then that kind of behavior will filter to the non-cardiac physicians and, more importantly, to the patients.
Yes, and then we will see a decrease in healthcare spending, and we'll see an increase in the health of our population. That could be quite dramatic, I think.
I agree completely. It spontaneously came to me that, you know, we're talking about healthcare expenditures, and I said, what are we talking about when I'm looking at all of the data? This isn't healthcare. This is sick care. Why don't we do healthcare?
Why don't we do healthcare indeed? Kim, I want to ask you about a related topic, and that is the role of inflammation in heart disease. Do we now have compelling evidence that people with inflammatory conditions, people with inflammation in their bodies, are far more likely to develop cardiovascular disease?
We do have probably the best example that we have is the so-called Jupiter trial, but there are loads of examples that have been calling out to us for decades. Patients with rheumatoid arthritis, patients with lupus, systemic lupus erythematosus, people with chronic inflammatory conditions who end up having a very high cardiovascular disease rate.
Based upon the studies that we do have, and also on your intuition as someone who has been looking at this field for a long time very carefully, mm-hmm. would you say there are food choices that produce more inflammation, and at the same time, are there other food choices that are anti-inflammatory?
You can think very much that it has a lot to do with animal products, and the more of them you eat, the higher the C-reactive protein is going to be, and pretty much everyone who goes vegan, they kind of disappear, and for all of the inflammatory markers. And to that end, there are a variety of diseases that one could do a search engine, you know, punch up lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or inflammatory bowel disease and see dramatic improvements in outcomes if someone goes on a plant-based diet.
I want to ask you one final question. It's in a different topic in a way. There have been a huge number of popular hospital-based TV shows, MASH, ER, Doogie Howser, MD, Grey's Anatomy, General Hospital, House, Nurse Jackie, there's lots of them. Do you have a favorite of these shows? And in general, what's your view of the messages they convey to the public?
So two very separate questions.
Yes.
Because the entertainment value may not be related to what the messaging is. So I have to say that, I'm a Grey's fan like many people, but the one that I liked the most, of course, was House because it was so ridiculous. And yet, they were usually done very well. I learned a fair number of non-cardiac things. It is funny to see an internist or a neurosurgeon doing a coronary angiogram and things like that. There were some bizarre things in it, but you know, I will always remember not to go into a cesspool for swimming, and so I don't get naglaria going up and eating my brain. And you know, perhaps if I had been in medical school recently, I would have found out that sort of thing. But I learned about it in a house. It's interesting. The more bizarre the diagnostic dilemma, the more I enjoyed the show. And so I would highlight that each one of these shows has an opportunity to talk about lifestyle issues and educate the public. And I would challenge them all to try and, for example, if you look at Grays, there seems to be a specific agenda in terms of gender and ethnic diversity that's displayed, and it seems to be a very, you know, a very upfront message. Why not do that same thing with lifestyle? And you know, you hear things mentioned, but it's something that I think they could show. You know, have a whole show on how you changed the hospital food because you wanted to decrease bad outcomes, et cetera. So, but that's my feeling, that they have a good platform to change the minds of many Americans.
Well, I'd like to see them use that platform for that purpose. And I'd like to see our whole culture shift to make it easier for people to both to understand the benefits of a plant-strong whole foods diet and also to make those kinds of choices on a regular basis and enjoy the fruits and benefits of doing so. And if we do move in that direction as a culture, it will be largely thanks to people like you, Dr. Williams. And I really appreciate the work you've done, the pioneering work you've done. You are the first vegan president of the American College of Cardiology. You're a pioneer in so many ways, and it's been a real pleasure and a joy to have you with us today.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, and I just want to throw that back at you. I'm really proud to hear of your story, very encouraged by it, and the fact that this is what you're doing instead of selling ice cream is really, really impressive to me.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking here with American College of Cardiology fellow and trustee and Rush University Medical Center Cardiology Department head, Dr. Kim Williams. And Dr. Williams, the way I see it is that there's a big difference between knowledge and wisdom. In your field, there are a lot of cardiologists who have immense knowledge about the treatment of disease, but sadly, when it comes to health and prevention, often tragically little wisdom. You, on the other hand, have spent decades studying, understanding, and teaching how to truly help patients to step into greater health. We're so grateful for your important work, for your wisdom, for your leadership, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you so much for those kind words. It's very inspiring. I really appreciate it.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.